This is the Tea on International Arbitration with Nicole Silver and Gaela Garin-Flores. Gaela is an international arbitration partner at Allen & Overy, and I am an attorney and an investment manager with third-party funder Validity Finance. Both of us serve as committee chairs of the DC Bar International Law Community, and we bring you now a Tea that explores a new technology venture called Arbitration City. We are delighted to welcome the company's founder, our former colleague and friend, Dmitry Evseev.
Before we jump into our questions, allow me to introduce Dmitry Evseev. As Nicole mentioned, Dmitry is a former partner of both of ours, most recently of mine at Arnold & Porter, where he spent over 15 years in both Washington, D.C. and London. Prior to that, he was at Winston & Strawn, where we all worked together as well. In his practice, Dmitry has served as lead counsel on investment treaty cases for numerous companies, as well as sovereigns such as Thailand, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Bulgaria, Costa Rica, Kyrgyzstan, and Sweden. In the past few months, however, Dmitry decided to leave big law and leave it behind to concentrate on being a full-time arbitrator and to pursue his dual passions in technology and building community through a new venture called Arbitration City, which is the main topic of our discussion today. We welcome you to the tea, Dmitry, and we are excited to hear all about your new beginnings.
Thank you, Gaela and Nicole. And of course, as you alluded to, we go way back, not just as colleagues, but also as friends, I believe. Both of you were, in fact, at my wedding many, many years ago. So it's great to be on the show, and thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, I remember when my daughter inserted herself into your reception line at your wedding. That was a special treat. And, you know, she was asserting herself very early on.
It was a great wedding, Dmitry. So, Dmitry, before we dive into your exciting new project, again, a tech company called Arbitration City, I wanted to ask you about your career move and what prompted you to leave behind the practice of law. As we were just discussing or previewed, up until recently, you were a partner at Arnold & Porter for over 15 years, representing sovereigns and companies in high-profile international disputes. And again, even before that, you and I and Gaela worked together in the arbitration space at yet another international law firm, Winston & Strawn. So given that you survived and even thrived in the legal market for so long, I have to ask, considering your track record of success, what prompted you to leave the practice of law after so many years, firms, and even countries?
So this might seem like an unusual move, although, of course, you now see many law firm partners starting arbitration boutiques or becoming full-time arbitrators, or like you, Nicole, going into another related field. Still, I think people tend to assume that departures like mine are precipitated by some external cause or maybe a conflict of some sort or business drying up. And I think all of you know that was not the case for me, and I could not have wished for better colleagues or more interesting cases or even better compensation, honestly. Although it is actually because of these factors that I stayed as long as I did, even though it was actually never my intention to spend my entire career at a law firm. Gaela, you actually interviewed me for an associate position in Washington back in 2005, it was.
Yes, I did.
You may remember that I actually told you at that time, look, I'm likely to leave in about a year to become a professor.
That's always a good tactic.
Yes. I think you said, hey, why don't you come anyway? And maybe you'll stick around. And of course, I did stick around. And then in 2010, I moved with my family to London to start Arnold & Porter's European-based arbitration practice. And I have to say, it's been a really good run, but you know, a busy counsel practice makes it difficult to also sit as an arbitrator, which I really enjoy. And it makes it impossible to do some things like starting a tech company, which I've always wanted to do. So I didn't want to make a move during the pandemic, but I think that provided all of us with a new perspective on what's important in life. And for me, it was important to take on a new challenge. And so I realized that there was no time like today, because another 20 years could easily pass in the blink of an eye.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Harkening back to when I interviewed you so long ago, I think that was at White and Case. And I guess even if double hatting weren't the issue that it is, I've certainly found that even in commercial arbitrations, if you work at a big law firm, conflicts are just a really serious issue. It's just difficult to get over conflicts if you work at a firm that represents a lot of the players that are in disputes. So moving on to the next issue, which is the tech company, I certainly know personally, you and I worked a lot on tech issues together, particularly at Arnold and Porter, and trying to really service our clients with the technology that's best in class. I know that we fought really hard for that, and that can be really, that can be very difficult sometimes, dealing with big law bureaucracy and just kind of tramping through those weeds of how to get the best tech. And things have certainly not gotten any simpler since GDPR, to say the least. So I wanted to pivot to Arbitration City and this idea of your starting a tech company, which I absolutely know has been very close to your heart for all this time that we've been working together. So can you tell us about this? What is this new venture all about?
Taking your first question about, you know, why I started this. And as you know, I worked in tech before becoming a lawyer, actually. I even co-founded a small company when I was in college. It was called Student Computer Solutions, and we helped to create some of the first computer networks on campus dormitories and sold network equipment to students. It was a pretty small scale affair. We were stringing wires by duct tape around the campus dormitories. There was no Wi-Fi back then, so it was a pretty fun little project.
Can I ask you a question that might date me and maybe not you, but when you were in college, did you have email that could go beyond your campus?
We had email, but not everybody was using it at the time.
Okay. That's for sure.
But, you know, I think most people were already. People were not using the web as such because as a graphical interface, that didn't really exist.
Yeah, I think in my experience, people were using the web pretty much solely for multi-user Dungeons and Dragons when I was in college, and that was about it.
Right, right. Well, in terms of what I did later, in law school, I actually did more work in tech and I ran servers for various organizations like the Harvard Law Review and the Harvard Law Record and the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Then, of course, I started working as a lawyer. And, you know, actually, my career in arbitration began at WilmerHale with a call from Gary Bourne, who said, hey, you have a technology background and you speak Spanish. Can you get on a plane to Colombia and help interview witnesses for a case? And, you know, Bogota was a pretty dangerous and exotic place back then. So, of course, I was very excited to go. But the name Gary Bourne meant nothing to me. And I barely had even heard of commercial arbitration at that time. And investment arbitration was, you know, really obscure with just a couple of firms doing it and just a handful of published cases at that time. So, you know, I think now it's a different world. We have a wealth of cases and literature. The field itself is far more prominent with thousands of young lawyers studying arbitration, looking to work in the field. And the world around us has changed, particularly from the perspective of technology. But I still feel the legal profession on international arbitration in particular is a very conservative field and is fairly slow, generally speaking, to adopt technology, which I know is a great frustration of mine, but also I think for a lot of the younger generation and more tech-savvy lawyers. You know, we're charging clients thousands of pounds for our time, yet, you know, sometimes takes 5 minutes to load up a computer and, you know, we send up documents and markups and attachments, and it's not, you know, always the most efficient process given the tools that are available. You know, how much time do we spend in cases on purely procedural administrative matters, which could be resolved, you know, more easily if there were, you know, calendaring or scheduling tools that were designed for arbitration cases. So I'm a firm believer that technology can make our practice more efficient and enjoyable. Of course, technology can also be complex and frustrating and make our lives hell. But in the long term, I think that the best solutions will prevail, and sometimes a push is required to speed things along. During my summers in college, I also worked in tech support for law firms. And around that time, I have to say, again, to date myself, firms were switching to Windows at that time, and lawyers and secretaries were learning how to use a mouse for the first time. And I can tell you, actually, a lot of people hated it. They couldn't figure out how to double click. And someone even thought that a mouse was a foot pedal. So, you know, if you took a vote the week after the new system was installed, I think people would say, hey, we should go back to the old ways. And, you know, a command prompt and using WordPerfect or whatever it was being used at that time. So I think it's sometimes hard for lawyers to understand what technology can do for them. And I think it's also hard for technology specialists to know exactly what lawyers need. So, I think I have an advantage in the respect that I have experience on both sides of this. But going to Arbitration City in particular, the company is really something intended to be a platform for all kinds of tech innovations in arbitration. But the overall push, at least at the beginning, is to create a social network, a private social network that's focused on arbitration in particular. So, you know, the target audience is really all professionals who are involved in arbitration, not just lawyers. It also includes anyone interested in international dispute resolution, such as students. And, you know, as you know, for many of us, arbitration is not just a job, it's a passion, and we want to talk to each other and exchange ideas and just interact with each other. But of course, we're located all around the world, and we spend most of our professional lives on our computers and our phones. You know, we dash around from conference to conference, which is perhaps not the most efficient or eco-friendly way, but it's the main way to stay in touch with people. You know, of course, we also meet up over Zoom, participate in mailing list discussions. But, you know, with the possible exception of LinkedIn, you can't really go anywhere online to talk to other arbitration professionals. ArbiCity or Arbitration City is not really about reducing the in-person interactions, but we want to help you make the most of your interactions and give a platform for professionals and organizations to promote their brand and to find like-minded people who have similar interests. So if you had a single app on your phone for different arbitration conferences and you didn't have to download a new one every time, and you could connect with, you know, fellow attendees both before, during, and after the event and have access to all the materials in one place, wouldn't that be really nice? The idea of our platform is that we would want to make that happen, and we would have lots of ways to find and share content. In terms of the modules that we have on the platform, we have a live feed, and that is similar to what you would have on LinkedIn. But then each user also has a shared media portfolio where they can showcase their presentations or favorite links from around the web. We have a people directory where we have arbitration-specific fields, and people can even upload their CV in a PDF format. We have direct messaging, so you can create chat channels, for example, with co-panelists if you're preparing for a conference. We have discussion forum where you can ask questions of others in the community. And every discussion starts with a question, but it can be sort of an open-ended hot topic discussion, or it can be I have a hearing in this location. Can you recommend a vendor, or can you recommend a venue, or anything like that? We will have a global events calendar, a jobs board. We also always welcome ideas for new features that can be added. It's really meant to be a platform to both bring innovations and also really to save time for busy professionals.
Thanks, Dmitry. That's super interesting. And I just have a few follow-up questions. Specifically, when is the platform going to be available? what are the company's goals for the next few months as you get it off the ground? And what do you see as the main challenges that lie ahead for RV City?
Thank you, Nicole. I think the platform will be available to the general public within weeks. We haven't set a specific launch date, partly because we plan to open it in different markets at different times. We'll have launch events that are specific to different cities. But even before that, we will have what's called an open beta version. So it will be a public launch where anybody can log in, but you have to recognize that it's still a work in progress. And if you want to see what we have early, you can come and look, or if you want to wait for a more polished version, then you can wait a little bit until next year. But we hope that everyone will join as soon as we open. We already have mobile apps available in the app stores for Android and Apple. So if you go on the app store and you search for RB City or Arbitration City, you should be able to find them and install them, but you won't be able to log in because we haven't opened the accounts yet, except for about 100 or 200 people who have been invited to do a very early test of the system and to help us get some content on the platform before we launch. In terms of the challenges and looking ahead, of course, in the next couple of months, we are going to be focused on product launch. And even though we already have a platform that's working and available, that's a really big job to get everything set up and ready for everyone to log in. We have, as I mentioned, a team of volunteers who are helping us, and of course, a lot of tech folks behind the scenes. We have an advisory council with some familiar names from the arbitration community, as well as tech and media specialists who are helping us out. Then apart from the technical side, there's, of course, the important job of getting the word out about the platform, getting everyone to try it, to download the app. And I think it might take us some time to get to a critical mass of users, but I think once we get there, then there will be a snowball effect. I'm asked who our competition is, and I think as anyone who practices competition law knows, everything depends on how you define the market. And to be honest, I don't really see Arbitration City as competing with any organization in the arbitration community. I think to the contrary, we welcome and are quite happy to help any organization to promote itself on our platform, to create groups, to share content. And we are not really in the business of creating content ourselves. That's up to the users. So if someone just wants to put up a logo and redirect to their own website or LinkedIn page, that's totally fine with us. But of course, that doesn't really take advantage of the possibilities that exist for cooperation, which I think are pretty endless. One big area of focus for us will be events, and we want to collaborate with event providers to help with the technical side of providing a forum for participants and panelists. We are working, for example, with Washington Arbitration Week, which is in just a couple of weeks, and we hope to have our platform available for participants in panels of Washington Arbitration Week. I think in terms of the real challenge, it's not really about competition in the arbitration space or even with platforms such as LinkedIn, which is not really going to notice us. We're going to be tiny, but really competing for people's time. And, are you going to play another game of Candy Crush on your phone? Or are you going to go look at arbitration content on your phone? So it's really a matter of very, very scarce attention. We're all really busy people. We have millions of distractions, important things to do otherwise in life. But I think that there is a gap in terms of having arbitration content available in a very mobile-friendly way.
Just following up on the subject of challenges, to me, making this new experience or making any new experience, as you already alluded to, with respect to people, using mice or mice as foot pedals. And just generally, in fact, just a few days ago, I was in a room of attorneys where attorneys were lamenting the new Windows system and how they were trying to get used to this new interface. So you know, from what I understand, you really want to present a product, a technology that provides people with a lot of convenience, a very convenient place to connect, to get information that is very relevant to their practice. And yet, you always find in the technology space this disconnect or need, perhaps, for some sort of very personal experience to force people, for lack of a better word, to actually use the technology to understand when it does. You know, so for instance, you mentioned a calendaring app. If that calendaring app actually has a robotic arm that will force the people to actually input their availability, I think that would be a great app, because it could be this wonderful, wonderful app. But unless, you know, there seems to be some sort of necessity at some point that someone is very personally in a room with another person, right next to that person, showing them exactly how amazing this product is, for them to really understand how amazing this product is. You know, whether it's a calendaring app or document organizational program that we use a lot, which is Evercron, you know, it's great. But, you know, how do you actually bridge that gap where it seems like people kind of need someone either hovering over their shoulder or actually like clicking the mouse for them to show them what to do? Kind of, I don't know if you remember, and I think it still exists, there's a link that is the "Let me Google that for you," where someone asks you a question that they could very easily Google for themselves. And so you just send them a link that says, "Let me Google that for you." And it kind of takes them through this experience where it shows them, look, this is how you can Google this. And look at the result. Isn't that amazing? Any chance that your product might somehow force people to have an experience so that they realize how amazing it is?
Well, I think there are several things that you mentioned that I think are important. One is the product has to be user-friendly. I mean, it has to be, in our day and age, you know, click and swipe and drag and drop, and that's the interface. You know, you're not going to be navigating complex websites on a small screen on your phone, and your time at your desk, you know, may be better spent on other things. You know, you need to have an interface that's very, very easy, very intuitive, very user-friendly. And I think you will actually find with RB City, it looks very, very similar to interfaces that you've used, you know, if you use LinkedIn or if you use Facebook or if you use any other social media, you'll find very intuitive and very familiar. On the other hand, of course, we expect to have features that will be of interest. I think you're right that people do need someone to sometimes show them something. But the other way is you actually need to get something done. And that's when you really have the incentive to go and try to figure something out. And let's say you need to find X person you met at a conference and you don't know who they are. And you go on LinkedIn and you're like, maybe this is the person, maybe this is not the person. Send them a connection request, you wait for them to reply. You could just go on RB City, and if they're on there, you send them a message and you're done with it. Or people register for a conference and, you know, you need to find the materials for X presentation, or you need to look up somebody's CV and you see if it's on there. There will be things that will make people look at it and try it. And then it's going to be our job to make them find that it's useful and interesting to come back to.
Thanks, Dmitry. I'm going to switch subjects. In addition to launching this amazing site, I understand that you're still planning to serve as an arbitrator and that you remain a member of Arbitra International. So can you please tell us a little bit about that and how you see yourself in that market and role going forward?
Yeah, so working as an arbitrator is still my bread and butter, and Arbitration City, I'm certainly not expecting it to put food on the table for me, at least certainly not for a good long time, if ever. So my main day job is still as an arbitrator, and I have seen this arbitrator market from different perspectives now. As a counsel, of course, you spend a fair bit of time on arbitrator selection. I've also been serving on the board of the Stockholm Chamber of Commerce Arbitration Institute for close to 9 years now as a member and a vice chair of the board. And a big part of what we do there is appoint arbitrators And of course, I've also myself taken on cases as an arbitrator over the last 10 years on occasion. And I have taught commercial arbitration. And in my courses, the composition of arbitral tribunals is something that students tend to be very interested in. I tend to spend a lot of time in my classes on that issue. So I've had a lot of time to consider this market from different angles. And I know that it's very competitive. And there are lots of qualified candidates. But I think that appointments ultimately just come down to a subjective feeling of trust. And who do you trust to dive in, to understand the complex facts? Who do you trust to run the proceedings smoothly? Who do you trust to work well with other tribunal members? And then from the counsel's perspective, to be receptive to the arguments that you will be making on behalf of your client. So I think that that is really the key. And even if you have served as an arbitrator for a while, those who make appointments might not necessarily think of you in that way if you come from a, you know, a counsel role, primarily as a counsel role. And they might also be concerned that they don't know enough about you in that capacity. All of these are, of course, challenges to overcome as someone who has just recently started as a full-time arbitrator. And of course, the other challenge is this bandwagon effect of the same people often getting appointed all the time. And, you know, sometimes this is for great reasons because they're great arbitrators, but there are also, of course, a much larger pool of candidates. And I think it's heartening to see the pool of arbitrators getting broadened from all sorts of perspectives. In the US, for example, I would be considered too young to be an arbitrator. Whereas in Europe, it tends to be that arbitration practitioners switch to becoming an arbitrator often at a younger age. I'm no longer that young. I think it's an interesting market. And I think that part of what I bring to the table there is, you know, understanding the counsel perspective. And of course, knowing many of the players, having, you know, examined probably most of the damages experts who are out there as repeat players at one point or another. And probably appeared before or sat with a lot of the arbitrators who you see appointed all the time, at least at many of the major institutions. So I think time will tell, but I have sat as an arbitrator in a couple of dozen cases, and I look forward to devoting more time to this.
Certainly, the question of how we select and who is selected as arbitrators in our tribunals is something that keeps me up at night. Particularly in terms of diversity and particularly in the world in which we live. It's interesting if it does all come down to trust and who we trust to be decision makers in our arbitrations, interesting to look at just how not diverse our tribunals are and what that says about our community and just how much more work needs to be done in terms of diversifying the pool of arbitrators. I think, again, it's just something that we can never stop thinking about. In some recent presentation I made, I quoted from a critical race scholar who had said that basically fighting against the forces that basically bode in favor of, you know, of white supremacy and male dominance and things like that essentially require one to not walk, but run in the reverse direction in one of those moving walkways. That's the type of effort that's required to really fight for and in favor of diversity. And not to influence your answer to this next question, Dimitri, at all, but what, if anything, other than the things that we've been talking about already, you know, becoming an independent arbitrator, setting up this awesome tech company, what else has been keeping you up at night these days?
Thank you, Gaila. And before I answer that, I do have to say that I couldn't agree more on the issue of diversity. And on the SCC board, I think we've been doing the best we can. And, you know, probably we've appointed more than 50% women, I think, as a running tally for the last year or so or more. And I think we appoint a lot of younger practitioners, and we may be able to do better on the geographic diversity. But I agree that is absolutely a top priority. As for what is keeping me up at night, I think for many of The folks who have seen some of my posts on LinkedIn wouldn't be surprised to hear that the war in Ukraine has been something that I have been not only closely following, but really experiencing in a very personal way, even though I don't have family in Ukraine, but I have, you know, a lot of family history connecting to Ukraine and to the region. And I have been posting ever since really February 24th, you know, regularly on LinkedIn, although not as much recently, but it is something that I feel very, very deeply about. I think it's not just a war about Ukraine. It's really a much broader than that. And it really affects certainly everyone in Europe and really everyone. And I think for decades, the effects of this war will be felt, and we will have to sort out, you know, global relations, human lives, we'll have to pick up the pieces as much as possible. So it is something that's been keeping me up and literally sometimes awake at night.
Yeah, I think in the very least, there was a bit of good news and steps in that direction of addressing the aftermath, or hopefully what will be aftermath and not current math of this conflict. And that was the UN resolution to establish the Reparations Commission for Ukraine. So I certainly hope that the world is in a place where it can actually get started on the reparations that are necessary. That was, I think it was passed yesterday afternoon. So that was good news to hear. But thank you so much, Dmitry. And thank you to the DC Bar. To check out more of what DC Bar communities have to offer, please visit dcbar.org/communities. And you have been listening to The Tea on International Arbitration. Watch out for new episodes. And if you like this episode, please tell a friend about it and subscribe or follow us anywhere you access your podcasts.
Maybe even on Arbitration City, right, Dmitry?
Indeed.
All right.